Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. I am, as always, Nick Bodick, and today we have a very special guest, someone who is near and dear to me in a roundabout way, even though I have only spoken to him a few times. He is the author of the books that have the best titles in all of horror. He is Mr. John Langan. How are you today, John?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Nick, and thanks for such a... That's high praise, indeed. There's a lot of great titles out there.
There are, but I mean, I'm not alone in saying this, is that, I mean, you start, like, Mr. Gaunt inspires curiosity, but then you get into, like, The Wide Carnivorous Sky. I mean, and then Corpse Mouth was just... As soon as I saw that, I was like, I already knew I was going to get the book, but I was like, I need it. And yeah, like The Wide Carnivorous Sky, Corpse Mouth, Children of the Fang. That was the first one actually that I read of yours, was Children of the Fang. Mm-hmm. And I picked it up on title alone, because I was, when I was a green horror, I wrote a lot of horror before I started reading a lot of horror.
And sure.
That one, Children of the Fang, drew me in on that one.
Well, that's good to know. That's good. I'll pass that back to the market research people.
For sure. So I start, when I'm speaking to authors, I generally start with the same question, which I will start with today, is what was your introduction to the horror genre? Just, was it movies, books, TV, and what about horror drew you in?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm in the process actually of trying to write an essay on that very subject. I've been invited to contribute to a collection of essays on the topic, why I love horror. And I've been thinking about that, because I have written about that before in the story notes to those collections, in different, you know, written interviews and in person interviews too. And so I've been trying to think about that and also not repeat myself too much, you know. I think in terms of media, the first media through which I encountered horror was film. And it was a version of Frankenstein that I have never been able to locate since I saw it, which means I'm probably not remembering it correctly.
You're but right.
To the best of my recall, my father was watching a version of Frankenstein, an adaptation of Frankenstein, in my parents' room, which had like the big TV in it, you know, and my mother wanted nothing to do with that. So she was sitting out in the kitchen with... In my memory, with my younger brother and the older, my younger sisters, my youngest sister, I guess, hadn't been born yet. And they were doing some kind of craft thing, like they were making these little popsicle stick men. And my father, in the meantime, had said, well, I'm watching this movie. And he said to me, you know, you can come in and watch it if you want. And so I would go in and I would watch a little bit of this movie. And in my memory, the screen has this kind of red cast, as if it was like some kind of poor quality print or something, or maybe it was our TV. I don't know. There's a scene with the monster, who's wearing a fur sort of vest and what looked like jeans and sneakers. And he's chained to a rock. And somebody, and I guess it's Dr. Frankenstein, is trying to talk to him. And I think there were other things. Because then I ducked out. I was like, nope, that's too much. But then I went back in again, and then I ducked out, and then I went back in again. And that left me with this lifelong, that was the beginning, you know, left me with this lifelong fear of the Frankenstein's monster. I have watched, you know, many movies since then and read Shelley's original and taught Shelley's original and so on. But, you know, there was a movie, I think it was a Canadian production a few years ago, man. And it was called something like The Frankenstein Experiment or The Frankenstein Tapes or sort of Frankenstein Legacy. I don't know, but it was sort of a found footage film about these people who realized that, you know, one of their great, great grandfathers was Victor Frankenstein and he created the monster and it's in Canada. It's in the Canadian wilderness, right? And the film makes the very inspired decision not ever to really show you the monster. But there's a scene where the characters are out in this kind of a meadow, And the monster is behind the trees, these trees. It's advancing towards them. The trees are shaking and the thing is just howling. And at that moment, I was just like back to whatever age I was, you know, 6, 7, something like that, just utterly terrified. And so that, that's in a sense, like that's kind of the beginning, I think. When I was a freshman in high school, I read Stephen King, Christine specifically, but then I followed that up with Night Shift and Pet Sematary. I mean, really anything I could get my hands on, The Shining, Salem's Lot. And that was the sort of turning point, you know, that was, which to me, I remain fascinated by that. You know, I remain fascinated by these moments where something happens and just boom, that's it. You know, you're sort of set in a particular direction. So, I'm still a big wimp when it comes to horror movies. I've read a lot of horror fiction. And it's funny because most people I know say it's the opposite for them. Like for me, the movie is completely out of my control and that makes it really frightening, you know, whatever is going, because of course, until you see the monster, if you see the monster or the threat, whatever it might be, your mind is conjuring up all these crazy things, you know? And then when the monster finally does show up, it may be frightening, but you're, as Stephen King likes to say, you know, you scream, but it's with terror, but also with relief because you're like, ah, oh, I thought it was that thing that lives in my head. I thought it was a Frankenstein's monster that lives in my head, you know, oh, it's just an alien, you know? Whereas most of my friends say, oh, I just look at it as like, it's just a movie. It's different. You know, like it's just special effects. It's just, whereas a book, most of my friends will say that gets inside my head that I have no control over. Whereas for me, I'm like, no, it's words on a page. It's fine. It's not, you know, like I can close the book, you know?
Yeah. I'm on your side with that. I am the same way. I can read any and all horror fiction there. And that's not to say that books don't creep me out. They often do. And I love that. But when it comes to, so like with movies, I was going to watch Long Legs the other day. My fiance's on vacation right now, and I got like 15, 20 minutes in, and I was like, wow, I feel like such a bitch because I'm right now going to stop this movie until my fiance's home because I'm getting creeped out in my house by myself watching.
You just say, honey, I didn't want to have this experience without you. That's, you know, I love it when we watch movies together, you know?
When she called me yesterday, I mentioned, I was like, yeah, so I found this movie that I started watching, and I was saying it in a way that was kind of giving her the...
Right. Come on, honey.
And she literally said, like, you got scared, didn't you? I was like, no, shut up. You got scared.
Right.
But yeah, no, so I'm totally, I agree with you there. Movies definitely, and I understand the point that with words on a page, it is, like you said, your mind creating the whatever horrible thing it is, entity, monster, alien, whatever. But with movies, I don't know, giving it that I guess already predetermined physical form just works on me for whatever reason. And it, like you said, I don't think I've ever really realized it, but like you said, it's out of my control. Like I can't control what that thing looks like anymore. It is as terrifying as it is.
And I think, I also think for me, I mean, I was growing up and getting my sort of first real or prolonged horror exposure in the 80s. So, there wasn't streaming, and so what that meant was that horror movies, let's say, you either had to go to the movies to see them, which was no way I was going to do that. And you could, I mean, we had, something when we got a VCR, we must have gotten a VCR about the mid 80s, like 84, 85, something like that. But there was no way my parents were ever going to let me rent like an R-rated horror movie. You know, that was out the window. And those things weren't shown on network TV by and large. So the horror, the horror movies I could watch were older ones that were on the local stations, usually on the weekend when they were trying to fill up time. I didn't watch really those either. You know, like I found those equally frightening. But at the same time, in the '80s, of course, you have this horror boom. You have Stephen King and Peter Straub and Charlie Grant and Anne Rice and all these different people who are just producing this tidal wave of books. And I could read those. My parents didn't really care about those. Their biggest concern with Stephen King was that they thought he used a lot of bad language. That was what they'd heard. And they were afraid that they didn't want me to be exposed to that, you know? And I was like, you guys don't know the half of it.
Yeah, that's forever the dilemma. It's like, oh, just wanton violence is okay, but no sex.
And, oh, absolutely. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Terror is fine, but no cuss words.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've had this same, I mean, you know, for decades, I feel like I've had the same reflection, you know, that oh my god, yeah, it's okay, all, you know, extreme violence is all right, but oh, don't show me a boob, you know, that's
exactly
just, that's,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I luckily I come from a family that is pretty on the level with all that stuff. If they didn't want to expose me to anything, and they kind of realized, because it was both my mom and dad separately told me, they were like, well, I mean, why would I be okay with you watching Boogie Nights if I'm not okay with you watching Saw, for your random example?
Right.
And I was like, okay, I get it. I wasn't happy about it because I wanted to go rent. I did. Like, that one was actually accurate. It was, I want to say 2001, 2002. So I was like 11, 12 years old, and I wanted to rent Boogie Nights. I don't remember why.
Because it was forbidden. It was like, this is a movie about the porn industry, you know? Like,
yeah, I think that was probably why. And yeah, but no, to their credit, they held firm on that.
At least in your case, they were not hypocritical, right? They were consistent. Yeah. And I think when you're a kid, you can deal with consistency better than inconsistency. Inconsistency, especially when you become an adolescent, inconsistency really bugs you. You know, it's the H word, hypocrite, becomes incredibly powerful when you're a teenager, before you realize we're all just hypocrites, and you're like, ah, whatever.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Yeah. And then to go back to something you said earlier about watching that, or I guess having that idea of a Frankenstein movie in your head that you haven't been able to find, just total aside here, there is a scene from a movie that I am 100% positive I saw when I was a kid. And I think it was the movie Broken Arrow. In my head, it's the movie Broken Arrow with John Travolta and Christian Slater.
Yep.
And in it, there's a scene where there's a big like fan that is like the size of the wall, and it's going, and someone gets pushed into it, like a criminal gets pushed into it. And I remember that scene terrifying me as a kid. I had nightmares about it.
I've
never been able to find it. I've asked on Reddit, I've asked on every possible social media, and it just drives me crazy. So I can, if your Frankenstein dilemma here is driving you crazy, I can relate.
Well, I'll tell you what's even crazier was in the 90s, I guess, it might have been, I read Peter Straub's novel, The Throat, which I think is maybe like his single greatest novel in some ways. I don't know if it's my favorite, but anyway, and I remembered quite vividly this chapter in The Throat, which detailed this one character who's trying to find another character, and he's taking this trip up into the highlands of Vietnam and all this kind of stuff. And I absolutely remembered that. And when I reread the book, it wasn't there. And I recently listened to the audio version of the book, and it's still not there. And like listening to it this time, I was like, oh, okay, there's a couple of scenes that I think I sort of conflated, but nonetheless, I was sure there was an entire just chapter of that book, a big 50-page chunk of it that is just not in the book, yet somehow in my memory I placed that or expanded those little bits into this great big chunk of the book. Maybe that says or says something about me, about the impact that those little details had on me, that they assumed this tremendous importance. But yeah, it's freaky, isn't it? It's one of those Berenstain Bear things.
The Mandela effect.
Yeah,
the human brain is a wild thing. But yeah, like I There's a few things I have like that, similarly that going back, but I won't get into all that right now. So your a lot of your work, not all of it, but a lot of your work has a very distinct cosmic slash Lovecraftian slash weird with a capital W fiction kind of bent to it. And what is it about that, or I guess it depends how you define those. Some people three different ways, some people all the same, but whatever it is, what is it about that range of horror, that kind of corner of the genre that draws you in, as opposed to, say, like splatterpunk or psychological thriller, which, I mean, I know you read a whole bunch of different genres, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I absolutely lean, I'd say monsters. I always sort of lean towards monsters, the supernatural, the supernormal, you know. One answer to that question, I guess, would be that when I was a kid and I was reading, it was more reading King and then Clive Barker. Those guys would include these little throwaway lines and references. Especially when King, before King really started to focus on completing the Dark Tower books, when that was something that would occasionally pop up, you know, cause a wheel or something like that, and you would just be like, "What does that mean? Where did that come from?" You know,
Yes.
and Barker would do the same thing, right? With you know, in the Hellbound Heart, you know, with the Cenobites and so on. And so what I loved about these books was the impression that they gave that there was like this vast kind of universe out there beyond the books themselves, that the books were just taking place against this massive backdrop. And I love that sense. I love that sense, which I didn't really read Lovecraft in any kind of serious way until I was in my early 20s. I did read The Dream Quest of Unknown Caddith when I was like 14 or 15 because Stephen King recommended Lovecraft, and that was the only book I could find, and I read it and I was just like, what the hell is this? This is not, you know,
That
this is
is
not
a
a
weird
horror
place to
novel.
start.
Yeah, and so it wasn't, so I kind of, in some ways, I feel like I missed out on that kind of primal impact that Lovecraft, you know, can have on people. I think, you know, I read in comparison or contrast, I read a lot of Robert E. Howard when I was oh man, middle school basically, and the Conan stories, but then also a collection of stories which I maybe read it. I might have read that in my teens, called Wolf's Head and Other Tales, which had all these kind of like horror or horror adjacent stories in it, and I think at his best, Howard would evoke something similar. The difference is, I guess, that, you know, the nameless monster shows up, but Conan takes it out or whatever, you know, that it's there's a way to defeat whatever the thing is. But those guys really gave just to you know, to pick three, and then yeah, sure, later Lovecraft and Thomas Ligotti, say, gave this sense of this enormous context, and I just love that. I just love the thought of these kind of vast, shadowy realities that were moving around just outside of view, just briefly maybe coming into view. So yeah, I think that when if and when I can evoke that in my fiction, I'm really happy to do that. I really love the thought of giving the reader a glimpse of something larger than the story. And that informs the story, and that afterwards, I hope, kind of bounces around inside the reader's brain in some way. It's funny because I never really thought of myself as, like I say, a cosmic horror writer. I just thought I'm writing about monsters, you know, and yet, absolutely, when people say to me, "Oh, but you know, this story or this story, cosmic horror," I have to say, "Yeah, you're right. It's yeah, you're absolutely right." So, same thing with weird fiction. I think in recent years I've become a bit more interested in kind of some of the effects of weird fiction, because I've been reading a lot more of people like Robert Aichman, or paying a lot more attention to a writer like Brian Evanson, say, these people who are, or Stephen Resnick, Tem, these writers who are kind of deliberately elliptical and opaque, and I'm really fascinated by that. So some of the stuff that I've been writing has played around with that. But you know, then I wrote a story a few years ago for a tribute anthology to Matthew Bartlett, who's a fantastic weird horror writer, you know.
Oh yeah, we love Matt around here.
Yeah, and I kept up with it until I threw a kaiju in. The very end, there's a giant monster in Leeds. So you know that there are times I feel like, you know, which I mean, you could argue that kaiju are a kind of cosmic menace and blah blah blah, but to me it's just like it's a big monster, you know. And
yeah,
so I the writers I think of as much more weird than I am, among my contemporaries, someone like Michael Cisco Bartlett, obviously, you know, like I think that those are the people who are working like mining the heart of the weird or something like that. I see myself as every now and again, I kind of traipse in and I'm like, hey guys, what's going on? And I do something and then I traipse back out again.
Yeah. I feel the same way about my own stuff. I've been trying to, I found it hard to commit totally to writing what I guess, because weird fiction as a term, I feel has a very broad definition that can mean mm-hmm. a lot of different things to a lot of different people. We talked yeah. about that a while back. And you know, going by my definition, I've found it hard kind of to break the, I guess the writing habits that I already have instilled in me that I've been writing with for the last 7-8 years, however long it's been, and to kind of let go and not feel the need to, I guess, wrap up every loose end. Mm-hmm. People who have read my book are going to be like, you didn't wrap up any loose ends in that. You don't have a problem with it. But like, that's not what I mean.
Right. That's different.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's, I like kind of, like you said, just traipsing into these different subgenres and messing around in them. And yeah, that's fun. And I have noticed it in your stuff. I noticed it in Corpse Mouth, in certain spaces in that.
Oh yeah, really kind absolutely. Of evoke
that eerie feeling that only stories that I don't want to say only weird fiction is, or like a feeling that I only get from when I'm reading weird fiction in a way.
Well, I think that's because I agree that like weird fiction is this kind of capacious term, and I feel like it was adopted. It was initially I saw it as another attempt to evade the label of horror. It's not horror. It's weird fiction, you know.
Yeah.
Which kind of irritated me because I'm like, I get it. I totally get, you know, what you could call the branding problem. I totally get that when you say to your friends and family, "Yeah, I write horror stories," a lot of times, you know, you see the shutters come down over their eyes and they're just like, "Oh, well, whatever," and trying to figure a way around that is tricky. So I understand the desire to grab something like weird, which maybe doesn't work quite as well as people thought it did, but then I can see it developing into ironically like a kind of subset that's trying to identify what particular writers do in particular situations, you know. And I think that I think that there are writers whose work is deliberately deeply strange. I mean, what's his name? Aikman described his stories as strange stories. And mm-hmm. I think the idea was just, these are not quite like anything else. They're trying to be their own, you know, their own thing. And that doesn't mean that you can't identify certain common threads in them, that you can't read, you know, say, well, okay, Aikman tends to do these things, or Michael Cisco tends to do these things, or Bartlett mm-hmm. really likes leeches. But there's the thing, right? Like, so you look at Bartlett and you look at Aikman, and Bartlett is just quite willing to go all in. He'll hit you with flying leeches, right? You know, and yeah. There will just be, I mean, his short novel, The Obsecration, is some kind of small masterpiece, you know, because it fits the events and the material of an 80s style blockbuster novel, you know, 800 page doorstopper into about 150 pages. And mm-hmm. to a certain extent, he does that by stripping out all the slice of life stuff. And he's like, no, nope, we're all going to the diner from hell. And just, he just piles it on and piles it on and piles it on. And it becomes this exercise, I think, in the Baroque, you know, and just sort of seeing how far can you push things. And I guess you could, you could maybe make the argument that like Aickman in his weird way does that too. Aickman is kind of like, how much can I not tell you, but still freak you out or still make you feel something. So in both cases, you could argue that the weird writers, that maybe authentically weird writers, or however you want to put that, take certain methodologies, I guess, and a certain narrative practices and just run with them. They just push them to see how far they can go with them.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing the
obsecration. The obsecration. Yeah. Go out and buy it now, people.
I seriously, it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, I
remember describing it when I first read it to my fiance. I was like, this is somehow, at the same time, the most dense book I think I've ever read, but also the most like unfocused. Like, and I didn't mean that in a bad way. Like, it was just, like you said, there was just so much going on at once.
Yeah,
one
well,
time.
He's like the guy who's, man. Spinning all the plates at the same time, you know, and yeah. and he's like, now we're going to crash this plate into this plate, you know, and a little bit of it is going to hop over onto this plate. And, yeah, he's the thing about Matt Bartlett is, as much, if not more so than anybody else writing today, he's pursuing his own vision. He has his own, you know, his own take on things. And, yes. And he's just trying to see he is seeing where he can go with that, where that leads him. And sometimes it's really funny and sometimes it's utterly horrifying. And you can see, I think, connections, you know, there is a kind of a Ligotti element to what he's doing. I think that's fair enough to say. I think he also, you can see some elements of Laird Barron's stuff in what he's doing, yeah. Especially when Laird is at his most elliptical. But he's just, Bartlett is so much his own thing. I feel he's this kind of writer where you think, you know, in a better world, he would have a massive, like, you know, the collected works of Matthew Bartlett, like some yeah. major publisher or something like that. I kind of feel like he's the kind of writer who's going to get picked up like the French or the Spanish or the Italian, someone like that's going, oh, Matthew Bartlett, they're going to discover him. And it's going to be like, he's going to be like this legend in places like that. You know, the same thing that happened to Lovecraft and to Poe, you know, where they were picked yeah. up by the French, and the French were like, this is really good. And the Americans were like, oh, well, if the French think so, you know,
the blood man, not Bartlett.
Bartlett, he likes your flying leeches. Hey, it's okay. You know,
oh, I love it. Yeah, no, Matt is awesome. I just got his WXXT, the second of the omnibuses. I don't know if he's put out more than that, but it's the second.
I think there's as far as I know, there's only two, because yeah, I have both of them as well, and I saw him at Necronomicon, and he said that I think he's gonna try to stop with the third, but then he was like, but maybe I won't, or something. That may just be my wishful thinking.
Yeah, right. Like I love the stuff he does with the chapbooks. I haven't really gotten into chapbooks as like a, because he actually, like, he's given me so much advice on writing over these last few years, and thank you, Matt, if you happen to see this, you're the best, dude. But chapbooks are something I've always wanted to try, and I just have not been able to get into them, just because, you know, my own writing ADD or whatever. But the stuff he does with the omnibuses and those chapbooks are so cool. There's those little slices of this world that he's building piece by piece is fascinating stuff.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. It's one of the certainly in the past 10 years, it's been one of the most, you know, kind of interesting fictional projects to watch going on.
Yeah. And it was so cool when I saw that he was getting the tribute anthology.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like, oh, it's so cool. That, and I think Laird Barron got one as well.
Children he did, yeah, yeah. He got one, yeah. 10 years ago, something like that.
Oh, is
like,
that long ago?
Yeah, it was a recently. While ago. Yeah, oh, wow. it's In a similar way, it's an index to the effect that Laird's writing has had on people. You know, they were able to fill that tribute anthology very quickly, and I think they had to turn some people away. I feel that's a reasonable thing to say.
Oh yeah, for sure. He's one of the foremost horror authors writing today. I always feel weird calling someone a horror author because I feel like it separates them from kind of getting at what you were saying before. Like, I read horror.
Right.
Down. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? He writes horror. He is a writer who writes horror. It becomes awkward, you know, just easier to say horror writer or horror author or whatever and just, you know, let it go. We know it's not a pejorative term, you know?
Right. Yeah, for sure. Way back at the beginning of this, you just made a quick comment that you taught Frankenstein.
Yes, I did.
Mary Shelley. And that actually leads me into my favorite story of yours ever, Technicolor.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, that was like a profoundly influential story, for me as a writer. And just I love it as a fan. But I guess I'm just curious how that story came about. Were you talking about Poe one day in your class and was like, this is actually could be a story? I'm just kind of curious about the background behind that story.
Well, I think I say this in the story notes, so I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but in some ways it goes all the way back to my freshman year of college, where we read a selection of Poe's stories in one of my classes. We read The Mask of the Red Death. And the professor said, okay, your homework tonight is to go home and to look at The Mask of the Red Death and to look at the description of the Abbey, of Prince Prospero's Abbey, which has a succession of rooms running east to west, each one of which is a different color. And I want you to figure out what's the significance of those colors. What do they represent? So, of course, you know, the next morning Monday, Wednesday, something like that. Anyway, the next class we came in, and we all had our elaborate explanations. This represents the times of the day. This represents the stages of your life, you know, states of being, whatever, that sort of thing. And that the professor, you know, we wrote everything up on the chalkboard. This is when we still had chalkboards. And at the end of it, we see this huge list, and you can see some crossover, you know, but there's also some things that are very, very distinct. And we said to him, so what does it mean? You know, what's the right answer? And he looked at us and he said, I don't know. And that it was in some ways a very bold and very humble thing to say. It of course, you know, at that particular age, you're thinking to yourself, no, man, just give me the answer. Just, you know, give me the answer and no one gets hurt. So that stuck with me. And geez, when Ellen Datlow was putting together her Poe anthology, she reached out to me and she said, I think it was actually at a reader con that we were having a conversation, and she said, okay, I'm doing this anthology and, you know, I want you to send me something for it. And you have to pick a story so that there's no overlap, you know? And right away I picked The Mask of the Red Death, even though there were other stories I thought it would be fun to mess around with. Almost instinctively, I was like, that's gotta be the one. And I've always been able to kind of, well, maybe not always, but for a long time, I've been able to write in this sort of faux academic style, you know, this kind of analytical teacher, professor kind of voice. And so that was really what started it, was just, I'll tell you what these colors really mean. You know, I'm going to give you the answer that professor would never give me. But I guess you could say the answer is always death. You know, you always, in a sense, you always come to death at the end of it. And yeah, I've just for whatever weird reason, I find that I'm fascinated by and therefore able to make up like weird history to invent these characters and so on. I kind of feel that a lot of the sort of supernatural apparatus in that story, if you will, derives from stuff I was doing in the I guess like sort of mid-90s to early 2000s when I was doing a lot of graduate work in English. And a lot of the literary theory I was studying was all about language, and it was all about the power of language and so on. And that, I think, played into the writing of Technicolor. And it was just, it was fun. You know, when I think about Poe on the screen, I think about those Roger Corman adaptations, for better or for worse, you know, and yeah. All the gaudiness and the goriness of it. And Poe was never one to turn aside from the gaudy or the gory. So I felt justified in that.
Yeah, for sure. That's like, the story is just creepy. First off, we'll just get that. Just get that out of the way. But so I had up to that point never read Mask of the Red Death, so it prompted me to go back and read Mask of the Red Death, and I had read a little bit of Poe here and there throughout my however many years of life up to that point. And so that story kind of inspired me to go back, and I've read all the Poe I can get my hands on since then.
Yeah.
And another way that it really had an effect on me was when I read that story, like, I was aware that you could kind of do non-traditional, I guess, presentation in, mm-hmm. in stories, mm-hmm. and still tell stories, but just not in a, he did this, he said, you know, that kind of
right.
traditional prose. And that kind of, not even just Technicolor, but a lot of your work and others too, but really kind of opened me up to the idea of non-traditional, like, writing styles, I suppose. And like, I've found a particular affinity for the epistolary style, like journal mm-hmm. entries and book entries, and but anyways, Technicolor is a story where I was just kind of discovering that, and that really had a huge effect on me. And I just, there wasn't much more of a point to this than for me to say I love that story.
I'm happy however long it takes you to say that, that's totally fine. I mean at that point when I came back to writing horror in the very late 90s, one of the ideas I had was to take, you know, kind of like revisit traditional monsters and traditional texts in horror film and fiction, but to take those and then to bring those together with different kinds of like literary techniques. And so to write, I wrote a story in the form of a play, a zombie story in the form of a play, because mm-hmm. why not, you know? And I'm still trying to do that kind of stuff. I'm still trying to, I think more of my stories now, they may experiment more with that kind of, you know, Aickman leaving things out, you know, but every now and again, I just like to think, well, what if you told the story this way? What if you told the story from this point of view? Or, and, you know, there are sort of longer projects that I'm still slowly working my way towards, that continue that, because I just, in a way, I just think it's cool. I just think I feel like there's something really interesting about taking this, you know, the traditional monster and all of the baggage that goes along with it, and then smashing that together with some kind of different form of narration. Sometimes, as you said, you know, the epistolary form is very old, but it's not a way that we write stories a lot anymore. So to, mm-hmm. to bring those things together, a few years ago, I wrote a story for Ellen Datlow's anthology, Final Cuts. And it's a film collection, you know, film anthology, excuse me. And it's a vampire story, but it's an epistolary vampire story told through emails and told through online articles and such. And I thought to myself, on the one hand, like, I was like, yeah, that's being very true to the spirit of the vampire, even as I was trying to do some different things with the vampire.
Yeah. Final Cuts was such a cool anthology. All of Ellen's stuff is amazing, but Final Cuts, I love that one.
Yeah, that one I feel really got hit by COVID. It was really a sort of COVID casualty, you know,
Yeah.
that there wasn't. Ellen usually promotes these things pretty heavily with readings and that sort of, and it just, you know, all of that was just shut down. But no, I agree.
Yeah.
I think that's one of her finest anthologies.
Yeah, same, like the lineup, as always, not to say other ones aren't, but the lineup in that one is just unbelievable. I mean,
Yeah.
the amount of, and she gets all these people with good reason, yourself included. But so to sorry, I jump around on this a
No,
lot.
totally fine. That's totally fine.
You mentioned earlier Ligotti, and I like to talk Ligotti a lot
Okay.
because the guy fascinates me
Sure.
and his stuff fascinates me. So what, I how do I want to put this? I guess, when did you discover Ligotti, and what was it about his stuff that drew you in? Because I've asked this question to probably 10 different people and gotten 10 different answers.
I feel like I had heard Ligotti's name in the 90s, but it was all small press stuff. And again, that was a time when I was living in the Mid-Hudson Valley. And I actually, no, you know, it would have been even a little bit earlier than that. It must have been in the 80s. And it would have been, okay, so thinking about it would have been Primeval. It would have been Doug Winter's big anthology that Ligotti had a story in. And that was the first time that I read Ligotti, and I thought, oh, this guy's pretty cool. And then I don't think I saw anything until I lived in Albany, New York for a couple of years. And in one of the local bookstores, there was the Carolyn Graff edition of Songs of a Dead Dreamer. And I, with an introduction by Ramsey Campbell, and I was like, oh my God, this is Thomas Ligotti. You know, I got to get this. So I got it and I read it. Some of it worked for me. Some of it I just found kind of confusing, because it was so different from King, or Straub or Barker or Joe Lansdale. You know, it was so much its own thing. And so something like The Last Feast of Harlequin, which is a much more sort of traditional kind of story, that I was like, oh, okay, good. But then there were other things that just I kind of bounced off. And I had the sense, I had the sense with Ligotti, because I feel like around that same time, maybe, Weird Tales, I think they were in like they moved to a digest sized format, and their kind of approach was that every issue had a focus on a different writer, and it had some of that writer's fiction and also an extensive interview with that writer. And so the Ligotti issue and interview was really, really interesting, and I think that the interview helped as much as anything for me to understand, I guess, a little bit better what was going on in the stories. And later on, Grimmscribe, I think I know the exact like local Barnes and Noble, because I'd moved back to the Hudson Valley by then, that I picked that up in. And that one I went through, and that one had more of an impact on me, I think. But I think Ligotti, it was weird, you know, because Ligotti, almost like Lovecraft, you know, like the more I've read Lovecraft over the last 30 years, say 30 plus years, the more I've kind of felt like, oh yeah, this is cool, and look what he does here. And initially, when I was reading Lovecraft, I was reading him almost kind of academically, and now there's still a bit of that in my reading of him. But I'm also there were certain things I really like, you know, certain stories I really like, and I almost feel the same way that I was doing the same thing with Ligotti, was reading Ligotti really kind of academically, because at that point in time, so much of my focus on in my life was academic, was pursuing graduate studies in English and so on. And so I think I brought a lot of that to Ligotti, and I saw a lot of what Ligotti was doing through that kind of lens of deconstruction and again, an attention to language and the kinds of things that language does. A few years ago now, and I'm trying to, this might have been pre-COVID, it was when the Penguin edition of Ligotti's first two collections was published. I went to an event. I was part of an event where, God, Tobias Carroll, I think it is, who's a fine writer and critic, read one of Ligotti's stories, maybe two. He certainly read one, and it was hysterical. I had never realized how funny Ligotti could be. And that kind of fascinated me, you know, that made me think, man, there's still more to this guy than I realize. I always mean to sort of do a deep dive into Ligotti, you know, to just sort of submerge myself in his stuff. And I've sometimes wondered if listening to the audio versions, what kind of effect that would have. Because as I said, I think this is true of many writers, that there were things that come out when you listen to the stories that are not necessarily self-evident to, you know, in part because of the lenses I'm wearing, because, you know, like when I was reading Ligotti, I was thinking, you know, here's the heir to Lovecraft and all this kind of stuff. Right. And then you read him and you're like, yes and no, you know, like it's, so I think that like Ligotti's kind of ongoing concerns, obsessions, projects, however you want to put them, they fascinate me in part because they've been such an influence on people like Bartlett. You know, like there were so many writers, Billy Martin, who publishes under Poppy Z. Bright, you know, wrote the introduction to The Nightmare Factory, the big anthology of Ligotti's work, talking about his importance. So I think that there are ways in which Ligotti and Ligotti's work has probably disseminated in ways that I'm not even fully aware of.
Yeah, he's so the reason I ask that, and the reason I ask everybody who is familiar with Ligotti's work that, is because there's a story he wrote that it's not one of his more well-known ones, apparently. I didn't know this. The first story I ever read by him is called The Small People. Okay. And that story just gave me a feeling that no other story from any other author ever has given me. Sure. And I am on a quest to figure out why that story did that, gave me that feeling in that, you know, that way. So that was just, that was another piece to that puzzle that I was adding there. I'm trying to just compile everyone's answers to see if I can decode this story.
it's sometimes, I felt that way with a lot of Peter Straub stuff. When I was a kid and I first read Ghost Story and then Shadowland, you know, I was kind of like obsessed with those novels. I would return to them over and over again because I knew, like, I understood enough to know that I really liked them and I really thought they were cool. But at the same time, when I got to the end, I was like, but man, I know I'm not getting everything. I know I'm missing things. And that did not upset me. That was like, oh man, that means I get to go back and reread it. So I think sometimes it is a kind of process, you know, where you kind of read it and then you let it percolate in your thoughts for a while. And then you go back and you reread it and you'll notice new things. I mean, our second time through anything, right? We always see things we never saw before because now we know the story. Now we know how it ends. And eventually, we come to more of an idea of what's going on. You know, I re-listened again, did the audiobook of Ghost Story last year and there were new things. There were things I hadn't recognized before. Same thing when I did The Throat, you know, I was just like, oh my God, there's all this crazy stuff in here that even during my last reread, I never noticed. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Just different things, little things you pick up on that you don't when actually reading it. I can definitely relate to that. When I was a kid, I read every day. I would get home from school and I would sit in my room and I'd read books. Like that was just what I enjoyed doing. But as I grew up and, you know, got other hobbies, reading fell to the wayside, whatever, years later, I picked it up again. And I have so much trouble reading now, like in terms of actually retaining what I'm reading. And it has made me such a slow reader that like I found myself getting frustrated because just the way my brain is now, I'll read a full page, get to the end of it and realize that I've been analyzing a sentence on the second line of the page, and I haven't been paying any attention at all to what I've been reading since then. So yeah. Audiobooks have been a huge help with that, and I really like having someone kind of, you know, someone else read it to you essentially is, I don't know, for me anyway, I'm able to get into those little nooks and crannies and extrapolate those things I would never have gotten actually like physically reading the book myself. So
yeah, I
get that. Yeah. But back to you, John, sorry, we went on a long time.
No, I think, look, not that I'm not happy to talk about myself, you know, I'm an egotist, right? But there are so many writers, you know, Bartlett Legati, for example, right? That, that deserve to be talked about. And, and I think that, I feel like there's, I don't know. I just feel like I want to do that. I just feel like I want to kind of pay it around, you know, like pay it forward, pay it back, whatever. But, you know, these are the people that I'm reading. And in Bartlett's case, you know, we've hung out a bit together. And I want to be able to kind of pay tribute to their work.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. There's, this one guy, Nick Boddick. I hear he's doing pretty great these days.
I don't want to talk about Boddick. I don't want to talk about Boddick. That's, I cannot forgive him. I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah, no, he does. Okay. He does suck. He's an idiot. He sucks.
I'm not going to say anything more. I'm just saying that, that restaurant will never open again is just all I'm saying.
I have been kicked out of restaurants before. Different life.
I'm not taking the bait. Nope. I'm not going to talk about that, but suffice to say it nearly bankrupted Kentucky Fried Chicken. So
I like this bit and I want to try to get this going on this show just to be a recurring thing that just like tiptoes around these heinous things I've done, these atrocities I've committed.
Yeah. You can't even tiptoe around them. You have to keep like a cordon sanitaire. You have to make sure that you're really, really far away from them because my God. Yeah.
Oh man. I set myself up for that. I wanted to ask you just kind of, we are almost to an hour actually. Anyways,
that's okay. We have, you know, I have time.
Okay. So do you, or not do you, I guess, what is your, I wanted to ask you about your writing career, but in a more specific way. Do you recall the first story you ever wrote, the first story that ever really gained a lot of traction with readers? And then what is your favorite story of yours?
Yeah, the first story I wrote, I was, I think, in kindergarten. No, actually, no, first grade. We were allowed to write a story. Or I shouldn't say we were told to write a story, but we were allowed to illustrate it. And that was really exciting to me because I loved to draw when I was a kid. And until I hit high school, I thought I was going to be a comic book artist. That was really my goal. But I went to Catholic high school, no art program, and also discovered Christine at the same time. So things took a different turn. But I wrote this story about King Kong versus Godzilla, because all the kids in my class were talking about that. And the thing was, I didn't really know what Godzilla looked like. I had seen a picture. It was probably from Son of Kong, where Kong Jr. is facing this four-legged animal, a four-legged dinosaur. And I thought, well, Godzilla must look like that. So I wrote this story about, you know, from King Kong's point of view. I was King Kong. I was walking through the woods. I saw Godzilla. You know, he breathed fire on me and set my chest hair on fire. And I picked up a lake and drowned him. And even at the time, right, I say this, you know, even whatever age that would have been, like six, I was like, that doesn't really work. You can't really pick up a lake, but you know,
that's where I got caught up too. I was like,
how would that work? You know? Yeah, exactly. he should have picked up Godzilla and thrown him in the lake I remember drawing the picture and I was really happy that I got to draw the picture. When it's funny, when I was, fifth or sixth grade, when everybody's obsession was the Lord of the Rings, was the Ralph Bakshi rotoscoped Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. We had a Halloween writing activity in our class, and we just had to write a Halloween, scary Halloween story. And I wrote a story about a kid who goes out to the, you know, there's like a barn behind his house, and he sees a Nazgul there, although I didn't call it a Nazgul, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think I may have even seen the Rankin Bass animated Return of the King with the king of the Nazgul with his glowing eyes, you know, because that was what I described. There's this shadowy figure, and there's, you know, and I think I far and away wrote the longest story in the class. Most people wrote like a page, you know, and I remember the teacher like drawing the blinds and turning down the lights. Now, whether this actually happened or not, like, but in my mind, and I started to read the story, and there came this moment where I could feel I had everybody's attention. I could feel, you know, I had them all in the palm of my hand. That there's this particular kind of energy that you become aware of, this focus of everybody on you. And that I think carried with me. I didn't realize it at first, but that carried with me. In terms of my favorite among my own stories, I mean, it tends to be the one I'm working on at the moment, you know, that's, or the one I'm most anxious about at the moment. So, you know, when I wrote Mr. Gaunt, there was a long time where I was really anxious about that story. I was really anxious that I had peaked with that story, and that was as good as I was ever going to get, you know? Yeah, I think it's because if you have any success, and if people say to you, Nick, I really love that story about the Kentucky Fried Chicken incident, then, you know, like the more people say that to you, the more you're pleased. But you know, I feel like the writer brain, you know, is prone to self-sabotage, you know, and so the writer brain is like, yeah, so I guess that was, you probably pack it in. That was probably about as good as it got for you. And I think that you just have to ignore that, you know, like, because I don't know that you can necessarily fight it. You know, I think that you have to ignore it, do your work, and let the additional work that you do kind of build up. And what happens is at a certain point, you're like, well, that was still a good story, but there've been some other good stories too. People told me, you know? So I think that, that's the way that you kind of get around that. If at least short term, I don't ever want to feel that I've like peaked as a writer, you know, like I don't ever, you know, I will say that the last story in Corpse Mouth, Keenid, which is about my mom, I have a sort of sentimental attachment to, but that's just a sentimental attachment.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know how I've made it an hour into this interview without mentioning this so far, but The Fisherman, that is one of my all-time favorite books, and I wanted to talk to you about that. So that seems, you know, to me as a reader, that reads like it was at least in part somewhat inspired by, I guess, real-life circumstances. I could be totally off base on that. I don't know. But I'm just curious as to how The Fisherman came together. Did you set out to start writing a novel and then that's what we ended up with? Or was it something that evolved from a shorter story? And then on the other
Yeah,
side
no, it was definitely evolved from a shorter story. At that time in my life, I was really anxious about being able to keep writing stories. You know, like I would read interviews with writers and they would say, you know, my brain is this unending well of stories, and I'll, you know, the rest of my life, I'll never get to the bottom of it. And I would think I would feel really jealous and a little intimidated too, because I didn't feel that same way. I didn't feel like my head was brimming with ideas. So I had this idea that I would write one story a year and try to publish one story a year. And if I could do that, I figured that was manageable, you know, and I could come up with one idea per year. That seemed doable to me. But to make things even easier on myself, I was like, okay, I'm going to go through those traditional monsters. And I did The Mummy, and I did The Skeleton, and so on. And I'm going to keep doing that. And so I was trying to find as many ways as possible, as many ways, I don't know, vines I could swing through the forest on or something like that, you know, as many supports as I could find. And at this particular time, my wife had found out that she was pregnant with our son. And I kind of knew that just I wasn't going to get a lot of writing done in the near future. So I started to write this story thinking this is going to be the last one for a little while. And it started off in part as a kind of riff on Moby Dick. And then it just grew and grew and grew. And I think by the time I'd started the middle section, the story within the story, I think I really kind of knew that we were heading into novel territory. And I kind of freaked myself out and was like, I can't write a novel. I'm not ready. So I put it away and started another story, which turned out to be my first novel, House of Windows. So it was like, my brain was just like, okay, we're writing a novel, you know? And then over the next several years, I returned to The Fisherman again and again. Every now and again, I would just pull it out. And then there came a point when Laird Barron, my good friend Laird, was coming to live with my wife and I. His life had kind of fallen apart on the West Coast, and he came over to stay with us for a while and kind of figure out his next steps. And I thought, man, Laird's coming. I better get this thing done. Like I'd been sort of working on it. And so in the couple of months before he got here, I just kind of knuckled down and finished the draft. And then sent it to my agent, and we shopped it around publishers who were like, this is really great, but we're going to pass on it. in terms of like personal experience, I think, you know, my dad died just before I turned 24. And we had this really, really contentious relationship that was maybe starting to kind of iron itself out a bit in the year or two before he died. And then he died and he just left, you know, it was just this catastrophe. None of myself or my siblings, my mom, none of us was prepared for it. And it really was like a kind of hammer blow to the family. And I just had this tremendous grief inside me that I didn't know how to deal with. And I don't know. I was very nervous about, like, say, going to therapy or something like that, you know. That's for people who were sick, you know. And so that was all kind of waiting there, ready to come out when the novel asked for it.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, it felt like, because it's the way that the, and I'm trying to avoid getting into spoilers here, because that is truly a book everyone should go into blind, in my opinion. But the way that it explores grief felt like such a, everyone has their own form of, has experienced some form of grief in one way or another. And like, I don't know, the way that you explored it, and I guess the lens through which you explored it was very relatable to me in such a way that it made me be like, okay, it seems like it's based on something real. And then actually regarding the story within the story, that's something else I wanted to ask about that was so jarring to me at first, the first time. Sure. I tried reading the book, that I, because again, it was one of these things, it was outside the norm that I was not used to. And so I think you kind of just answered this, but it read to me at first like that was an entirely separate story that you then found a way to work in. But from what it sounds like, that was just a part of the writing process of The Fisherman.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I thought that I recognized pretty early on that the story was growing, and I thought, this is probably going to be a novella. And I thought that the story within the story would probably be like 20 or 30 pages. Like, I thought it would be a significant chunk of the story, but I didn't think that it would be about the same length as the surrounding material combined, you know? And I kind of recognized, I mean, where I really left off for a good long time was in the middle of the book when Rainer and the other guys are going into the house that the fisherman is within. And I just sort of stopped there, and I wasn't really sure what to do there. Like part of me thought, oh, I was going to have the point of view character, this young guy, Johann Schmidt. I thought I was going to have him injured, and things were going to like sort of, he was going to hear things in the distance, you know, and then they would come back and be like, it's over. But that didn't, and then I was like, that's not quite right. That's, you know, and so I had all these different, like sort of these ideas that were, kind of evasions in a way. Oh, maybe the, you know, some monster is going to attack him, you know, like some, you know, fish creature is going to attack him, but it's only going to be one. And it was, the great Jeff Ford whose advice I poached from Laird. When Laird was writing The Croning, his first novel, Ford had told him, you know, you're going to feel the urge to play it safe. Fight that urge. Just go nuts. Knowing Ford, it was probably go fucking nuts. But, and I just thought, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm just, and so the book became a lot wilder, the middle part of the book became a lot wilder as a result. And I think even at the end, when we're just back to Dan and Abe, it's still though the landscapes they go through became a lot wilder as a result of that. Yeah. I liked the idea, although I understand that it doesn't work for everybody. I liked the idea that there was this kind of backstory that really explained the significance of what was happening in the front. That like if you had this backstory, and then you read the story in the front, you would be like, oh, right, I understand what's going on here. But I also knew that it was asking the reader to trust me, and to give me trust that depending, they might not feel I had earned.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've always felt that must have felt like a really big swing on your part, because
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right that it's become clearer to me with the passage of time. Oh yeah, this is, you know, this was asking a lot from the reader. It makes the rejections of the novel by the sort of, you know, big five publishers, it makes it make a bit more sense, because mm-hmm. especially from a writer who, you know, I would hardly claim I'm well known yet, but was even less less well known anyway. It was a lot to ask, and I can imagine them being like, we just don't want to take this gamble.
Yeah, I had truly never read anything like it before. It was the first, actually, because it's whenever there's a question on Reddit posted like, oh, it's a modern Lovecraftian story that you love or whatever, and The Fisherman is always like number one. It's always, every time. And it was the first longer, I guess, novel length Lovecraftian work I'd ever read, and I just totally lost my train of thought right there. I'm so sorry.
Well, it's a weird like it's you're like getting this. I can understand how somebody, you know, I think, given the associations we have with Lovecraft and his work, you know, comes to this thing, and it's like, okay, the first three chapters are, you know, these two grieving widowers, and yeah, there's some kind of weird stuff, but you know, and there's a lot of like fishing stuff, you know, and then you just dive into this historical narrative about building a, you know, a reservoir, and it's with, you know, and I can understand how people would just be like, how is this Lovecraftian? In what way is this Lovecraftian? You know, if I feel like if you persist, if you get to the end of the book, you're like, oh yeah, big monster, cosmic. Okay. Yeah. I sort of understand, but I think that where I probably part ways with Lovecraft most, I think, is in the amount of time I'm willing to spend on character. But I think Lovecraft does character more than he gets credit for. And you could absolutely say, oh, here are these two white guys, you know, going out to face them, you know, in the form of Abe and Dan. And you could say, oh, that's kind of Lovecraftian, in a, you know, in an unintentional way. But in the sort of the obsession with emotion, the obsession with grief that the book shows, I can understand that that doesn't necessarily seem to graft onto Lovecraft particularly well.
Yeah, for sure. That was the when I first read Lovecraft, the first thing I really like noticed from it as a in a literary sense was that, yeah, there what or I guess I should say what I perceived at first was that, yeah, there's really no character development. Like, they are essentially the same, more or less, just a bit crazier by the end of the story as they were in the beginning. But you're right, I also have since come to feel that he doesn't get enough credit you know, in that area, because there's quite a few of his stories that the characters do have shifts in their way of thinking, and it might not be some real super profound way that's going to change their personality forever, but they are learning from the things that the information they're taking in and the people they're talking to, and it is coloring their outlooks in a way, which I feel like that's what character development is.
Yeah. And I think that Lovecraft, he shows maybe a narrow focus, but a focus on relationships among men, friendships among men, quite often a kind of mentor mentee relationship between often an older man and a younger man. And often in his stories, or often enough, it becomes the duty of the older man to in some way avenge the younger man. I find so there, as I said, you know, it's very narrow, you know, like, but it is there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, John, I really appreciate you joining me today. Like I said, I've been wanting to have you on here since I started this way back when, and I'm so glad we were finally able to do it. If anybody wants to find you, find your work, where can they do so?
Oh my God, I'm all over the internet. It's disgusting. I spend far too much time on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Threads, Instagram, Blue Sky. I don't yet TikTok. I doubt I ever will, but having said that, who knows, next week I'll be like, look, join me on TikTok, fam. So yeah, exactly, doing weird dances, talking about the Kentucky Fried Chicken incident, and or not talking about it, as the case may be. So yeah, you can, and I have a blog which is called Mr. Gaunt, so if you look that up, you'll find me. I intermittently update it. I'm not really good at that either. So there you go.
All right. Awesome, John. Thank you again so much. And I'll definitely talk to you soon.
Yes, you will. And thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure's all mine. Take care.